Comic books are big business, and comic book superhero characters are even bigger business. We'll be talking about that business today on Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and the hour starts with Bill Roseman. He's an editor at Marvel Comics. The Avengers Arena storyline wrapping up now in the Marvel Ultimate Universe is one of his projects. And Roseman will talk about what goes into creating a superhero character and why they have such appeal. A lot of that appeal is in the movies, and later on Focus, I'll discuss the superhero movie business with Mark Hughes, a screenwriter who also writes about superheroes, movies, and superhero movies for Forbes and other publications. Our program continues after the news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Today's program looks at comic books and superheroes. Later in the program, I'll talk about superhero movies with Mark Hughes, who writes about superheroes in the movies. But first, an interview with Marvel Comics editor Bill Roseman, which was recorded yesterday. Superheroes are fictional creations, but the role they play in our culture is very real. Bill Roseman knows something about that. He's an editor and writer at Marvel Comics, the company that brings you Spider-Man, the X-Men, and the Incredible Hulk, among others. Bill will be talking about superheroes on and off the page this coming Tuesday at 7 p.m. at the Illinois State University Bone Student Center Brown Ballroom in Normal. And Bill Roseman, welcome to Focus.
Well, thank you, Jim. It's a pleasure to speak with you and to all the listeners out there.
Okay. You know, part of the thinking about, the thinking that I've been having about superheroes is just what type of person gets depicted as a superhero in comic books. So it's interesting to read, and I should note that this is news that came down on the day we're recording on Wednesday, November 6th, that Marvel is rebooting the Ms. Marvel character as a Pakistani-American teenage girl who is a Muslim. She's, and I was interested to see, she's not even Marvel's first Muslim character, but it's certainly a rare occurrence in Western comics. Why the decision to do this, knowing that it is going to cause some controversy?
Well, Marvel has never shied away from controversy. It's not that we pursue it, but it's that Marvel has a history of always being on the forefront when it comes to representing all types of people in our comic books. If you go back to the 60s, where Stan Lee and Jack Kirby were doing Fantastic Four stories, and Stan Lee and John Romita Sr. were doing Spider-Man stories, and even before that was Stan Lee and Steve Ditko in the earlier Amazing Spider-Man stories, the artists would draw African-American characters in the scenes. You know, when Spider-Man was swinging overhead, you'd see people look up, and there would be African-Americans. Or there was a scene where Peter was at his high school and talked to a kid who wasn't white, and at the time, that was a bit revolutionary. So, yes, we make decisions to reflect all of our society in our pages because we feel everyone should be represented. Not only is it more realistic, it grounds the stories in the world around us. I mean, yes, there's always the layer of fantasy, but it's built upon a very solid foundation of the real world, and that's where the power of Marvel Comics, more than any other company's comic books, come from, is that it's based on a bedrock of the world outside your window, and that adds a level of complexity and interest that other comic books don't have. So when it comes now to the new Ms. Marvel series, and I have to say that this isn't a reboot of the character per se, it's a reboot of using the name again. Recently, we had sort of promoted Ms. Marvel, who is Carol Danvers. She's a character that's been around from the 60s and 70s. Carol Danvers was Ms. Marvel, and she got that name, of course, back in the 70s when women's rights were in the forefront. So recently, about a year ago, we kind of said, you know what? She's earned it through all her adventures. Let's just make her Captain Marvel. Why make her Ms. Marvel? Why not? Let's give her the full name of Captain Marvel. So for the last 2 years, Carol Danvers has been Captain Marvel. But then, you know, I think we looked at that name, Ms. Marvel, that was very powerful, and it means something to a lot of people. So it began with a conversation between senior editor Steve Wacker and editor Sana Amanat. And Steve said to Sana, who's Indian, said, why don't you, you know, you, you, they were t- talking about when Sana was a girl and looking up to and wanting to be other superheroines and people in pop culture. And Steve said, why don't you make a character for you when you were 12 years old? So Sana really spearheaded this and worked with the writer G. Willow Wilson and the artist Adrian Alfana and came up with this character that we just announced, Ms. Marvel. And yes, her alter ego is a Pakistani Muslim teen girl because they wanted to, you know, talk about what is it like to be the other? What is it like to not be part of the mainstream? What sort of experiences do you go through? And I think this harkens back to our very first characters when you think of Peter Parker. He was not the jock, popular kid. He was the, bookworm, misanthrope in the corner that the kids laughed at.
This reminds me of the small media storm a couple of years ago when your company published an alternate Spider-Man storyline in the Marvel Ultimate Universe in which Spider-Man was both black and gay.
Just to correct that, it was an alternate line of comics we have called Ultimate Spider-Man. That we began right when the first Spider-Man movie came out from that Sam Raimi directed. And we wanted to kind of start the universe afresh so that people didn't feel they had to go back and read all the Spider-Man comics from the 60s. So we started a new line called Ultimate. And we decided, let's take some risks with this line and make it a bit different from our regular line. So while regular Peter Parker in the mainstream Marvel line was unaffected, we decided to kill Peter Parker in the Ultimate line. He made a heroic sacrifice and saved his family and friends from the Green Goblin and a host of his villains. But his sacrifice and his heroic actions inspired Miles Morales, who isn't gay. That was just something that grew out of media coverage of it. He's half black, half Hispanic. That caused a similar reaction. I remember the day after we did that, we received hate mail to the office. There was one father who even said he was going to go burn all of his kids' Spider-Man comics.
I'm wondering, the response you get, both positive and negative, does suggest that superheroes and these and certainly the most popular characters that a lot of people have grown up with, they really resonate with a lot of people. Why do you think that is?
They do because, you know, it on the surface they seem silly, don't they? I mean, it's these very muscular characters running around in very bright costumes and masks, doing these amazing things. They're running up walls, they're leaping over tall buildings. But what readers of all ages realize is the more you read these stories, the more interesting and complex these stories are, the more you can, if they're done correctly, you can relate to these characters. And they truly have something to say to us. They don't just entertain, and that's a wonderful thing. You read a comic book, and for 20 to 30 minutes, you are taken away from your everyday world. You are distracted from your problems. And that's a wonderful thing. Each week, new comics come out, or every few months, a new movie comes out, and that gives people something to look forward to. On top of that, the stories can be very inspiring. They can inspire someone to want to be their best. They can be very aspirational, especially with the Marvel characters. They all have problems. They all have challenges and feet of clay, whether it's physical challenges, some are in a wheelchair, some are blind. Or they have, psychological, emotional challenges. They are outsiders. They are picked on. And yet, faced with these challenges, and even because of them, the heroes rise up and they do the right thing. And so, yes, people become very attached to these characters that they first meet when they are very young. But as I said, the more they read and the older they get, they see how complex and interesting these stories are. And so these characters can stay with them all their lives, and they become very totemistic. I remember we were I was on the New York Stock Exchange for a press event with someone in the Captain America costume, and people ran up to him. These are grown adults who trade stocks for a living. They ran up to him, and it was for them it was Captain America. And one stock worker rolled up his sleeve and showed his tattoo. He had previously been in the Army, and he showed his tattoo of Captain America. And that tattoo helped get him through his Army experience, and to that day was an inspiration. So these characters have a very real impact and elicit true emotional responses from people.
You must have grown up with comics yourself, I suspect.
I did.
Tell me about your comics reading experience. What were you reading and when?
Before I could even read, some of my earliest memories were looking, and first there was the cartoons, you know, there were the Super Friends cartoons in the early, there were reruns of the Spider-Man cartoons from the 60s. And then, you know, comics were on every corner. So for whatever reason, they clicked with my brain like nothing else. I was always a voracious reader. I read, you know, novels and, you know, enjoyed all sorts of media, TV shows, movies, plays, you name it. But comic books always had a special fascination for myself. And I remember when I was in first grade, there was a book fair that came to my school, and I bought reprints. They were paperback-sized reprints of the first 20 issues of Amazing Spider-Man. And I read them, and I wanted to not just be Spider-Man, I wanted to be Peter Parker. He was smart, but also he felt like an outsider. But he had these great adventures. He had a cool job in the city, and he had these cute girls that he went on dates with, and he had problems that as a young kid I could understand. And he appealed to me. Spider-Man and Peter Parker appealed to me more than any other hero because he was close to my age. It wasn't an adult, it was a teenager, and the teenager was the hero. So Spider-Man always had a special place in my heart and brain. I read comics from before I could read, and I would look at them, and then when I could read, of course, I read them and read them all through high school and never stopped. Many readers will read comics until they're in high school, and then they'll get into dating, and they'll use their money for dates. And then what happens is they'll go to college or then get a job. And then most readers will then come back. The main reader is between 25 and 45. That's actually the main comic book reader these days. I stayed through it. I kind of bucked the trend. I never stopped reading. For me especially, they've always had an interest in one theory I had, someone explained it to me, they said, you know, when you read words, one side of your brain is stimulated. When you look at pictures, another side of your brain is stimulated. When you read comic books, you know, that unique combination of words and pictures, your entire brain is stimulated. So for some kids, including myself, that was something I couldn't get anywhere else.
How did you move from reading comic books to working in the business?
I was an English major in college. And I was interested in getting into publishing. I knew getting into comics was a long shot. There's only a few big publishers. So I was a fan of all publishing and literature. And first, I got a job at a New York publisher. But when I was in college, I happened to know someone who knew an editor. And so for spring break, when all my friends went down to Mexico to have fun in the sun, I went to New York City and interviewed and passed around my resume. One editor named Steve Sappel was nice enough to call me, and he was in charge of an in-house magazine that Marvel produced that covered their own comics. So he saw that I had journalism experience at school, I wrote for the paper, and that I also knew comics, and so he hired me on a freelance basis to write articles for Marvel's in-house magazine. So I started there. I was a freelance writer. And then I got into a spot opened up writing copy for a monthly sales catalog. And I came in through there, and then I got into marketing. And that wasn't my background at all, but it was my way in. And so then I did marketing for Marvel for about 8 years. And then and left and actually worked for the competition. I worked for DC Comics. And about 7 years ago, Joe Quesada, who was our editor-in-chief at the time, and he's our current chief creative officer, gave me a call and invited me back to edit comics.
Since you have worked for the two major comic companies in the U.S., is there a basic difference, like a different culture at the two places or in their product that you can easily describe?
It can fluctuate because there is talent who will jump from company to company, both freelance creators and editorial behind the desk. So the pendulum can swing back and forth as far as what the overall goal is in the publishing division. But I will say this, the DC characters, who I love, I'm a huge fan of Superman and Batman and you know, characters like the Flash and Green Lantern. Most of their characters were created back in the 30s and 40s, and so they were mostly just very much escapism. They were invented during the Great Depression. So a lot of their characters were their adventures focused on them in costume only. So subsequently, their secret identities weren't that complex. Who they were when they took the mask off weren't explored as much as they as the Marvel characters. The Marvel characters came along in the 60s. The country was in a different place. It was the rise of the teen culture. It was a time of upheaval. It was the battle for civil rights, for equality, and it was also during the Cold War and the fear of the bomb and all these very interesting elements going on in the real world influenced all the creators. So all the Marvel characters were made during a very different time and were made very differently. And as opposed to the DC characters that focus mostly on the characters while they were in costume, on the Marvel side of it, they very much explored the character as a whole. So first they really dug into who is Peter Parker, who is Tony Stark, who are the Fantastic Four before they get their powers. So they're just it's a radically different way of looking at superheroes. And just following that, each company has sort of, you know, they have very different DNA of when they started and their philosophies. And it really comes to life in the comic books.
Well, now that in your current position, you do play a huge role in defining the superheroes that that you once read yourself as a kid. What defines a hero? Are there basic ingredients as you create characters for comic books?
Well, the number one mantra as far as the Marvel heroes go, and I think it really applies to any good hero, is with great power, there must come great responsibility. So in other words, when Peter Parker was first bitten by the spider, he chose to use his powers for his own selfish gain. He was appearing on talk shows trying to make money, and he did not stop the burglar. There was a burglar who ran by, and he let him go. And that burglar ended up killing his Uncle Ben. And Peter, up to that point, was kind of a jerk. He was very selfish and self-centered, and he was an angry young man. And then when his uncle died and he realized that the blood was on his own hands, it changed his worldview. And he realized, oh, I need to use my powers to help people so that no one else can suffer the way that I did and the way that my aunt did and my uncle died. So that kind of is the blueprint for all the Marvel characters. There's a transformative moment, not only when they get their powers, but it's sort of they undergo an arc where they begin and they're not perfect, and they never are perfect, but at least they have an arc until they begin selfishly and then look out into the world and realize, I must help. You know, anyone can be strong, anyone can be smart, but to use those abilities to help others, that's the mark of a hero.
That's a sort of, and I was noting, I think, a talk I had seen of yours that's circulating on YouTube. You talked about someone who has a certain physical power, but also a moral center, as you were just describing.
Exactly. You know, characters like Spider-Man are beloved not just because of the abilities they have, but because of their, as you say, their moral character. You know, the example I give is, when Spider-Man captures a villain and he webs up the villain for the police to find, he doesn't leave a bill. He doesn't charge the police for his duties. Instead, he leaves a note that says, courtesy of your friendly neighborhood Spider-Man. So he does these deeds anonymously, expecting no reward.
That's the third thing, is that and that's where the costume come in. No one seems to be working as themselves when they're a superhero.
Yeah, there's a couple parts of that. Number one, you know, the mask is striking. It has a history in pulp heroes. The mask is interesting. It gets your attention. You know, the human, you know, when you look at a, anyone, you go to the face first. So when there's a mask there blocking the eyes and blocking the face, that gets your attention. And that gives that also then gives them the identity. On top of that, the costume and the mask symbolize the secret lives that we all have. It begins when you're a kid. There is the world, there's the adult world, and there's the child world, and there's the world that adults think they know everything that their kids know, but they don't. Kids know more than adults think they do. And the older you get into your teen years, and you begin to have lives separate from your family. And then you begin to have an interior life as well. You have thoughts that are secret from the world around you. And many people think, oh my gosh, if anyone knew what I was thinking, if anyone knew the real me, it would be the end of my world. And so that is reflected in the superhero. The superhero wears the costume to conceal their identity, to protect their loved ones, because they feel, well, if my villains find out who I am, they'll strike at me through my loved ones. But it also, the hero, you know, especially a hero like Spider-Man, thinks, if anyone finds out that I'm Spider-Man, my world would be over if my secret life is exposed. And that is it's a part of life that many people can connect with.
And that makes me think, of course, comic books throughout the history of the industry, and, you know, Marvel, as well as any other company, has published comic books in all sorts of genres. But the one that is certainly dominating and dominating today is the superhero genre. Is there a particular reason, do you think, for that to be so, considering all the stories that could be told and all the markets there are for those stories in other media?
Question, Jim. People always ask why the superhero when comic books, we always say, you know, the comic books are not a genre, they're a medium. They're a medium just like TV, just like film, just like poetry, just like novel. They're a medium. Within that medium, we can do any genre you want. We can do westerns, we can do film noir, we can do romantic comedy, we can do science fiction. And we do them very well. You know, there are many comics going today that are in all sorts of different genres. Marvel itself has a history of that. Back in the 50s, we did westerns and romance and monster comics. And in the 60s, when we did the Marvel version of a hero, it struck a chord. And I think they just captured lightning in a bottle. And these characters that were invented back then, who are still the stars of our books today, are just very special.
These are materials which are still being written for comic books. I mean, books on paper, but I'm thinking of all the other media that Marvel product now appears in and that comic book characters appear in. Are those things which are now on your mind as you develop characters and storylines, the idea that it may work through, say, TV and movies, that it may be on paper, but it may also be online? Do any of these affect how stories and characters may appear?
Keep in mind that Marvel is a you know, three-dimensional entertainment company. Many people now know us as a maker of movies. And so, yes, we know that we have film. We have TV shows like the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. We have video games. We have all sorts of licensed products. So on one hand, yes, this is always in our mind that there may be other opportunities for these characters. But when we create a comic, we at first try and make the best comic. We try and make the best story and invite our creators to tell the story they want to tell. In the long run, if it develops into something else, that's great. But we try not to let that get in the way of telling the best story possible.
You know, I was thinking, and maybe this can be our final question, going back to the dreams you had when you were reading comics as a kid. If you were a superhero, what quality would you want to have? And let me follow that up, because this is Marvel. What personal problems would you be willing to contend with?
Well, I always, you know, like many people, I see myself as sort of a Peter Parker character. I think we all see ourselves as an underdog who must deal with all the challenges of the world around us. We don't have perfect lives, but we always try and do the best thing. And even as a kid growing up, I related more to the more grounded heroes. You know, I couldn't really wrap my head around the characters who were off in space or fighting in other dimensions. I was more interested in characters like Spider-Man and Daredevil. characters who were in New York City facing sort of everyday problems combined with crazy superhuman problems. Let's see, for what kind of powers I would like, you know, everyone says they want to fly, and that'd be fun, and I wouldn't mind teleporting, so I wouldn't have to commute to and from work every day. But, I'd ultimately want a power that would enable me to help people. And, you know, I suppose as far as my challenges, I would be like any Marvel character who has any sort of physical or emotional challenge. I think ultimately it's worth it. And I think that's a lesson that we can apply to our lives here and now.
Bill Roseman, you are a true romantic.
I got to be if I'm spending all my days with Captain America and Iron Man.
Well, Bill, just want to let people know again, you'll be speaking at Illinois State University in Normal in the Brown Ballroom of the Bone Student Center. That's Tuesday, November 12th at 7 p.m. The talk is free and open to the public. And, Bill, thank you very much for being with us on Focus today.
Thank you very much.
And we recorded that interview yesterday. I'm Jim Meadows. This is Focus. We'll be back with more live talk about superheroes with film writer Mark Hughes. This is Focus on WILL. We're back on Focus on WILL. I'm Jim Meadows, and today we're talking about comic books and comic book characters. Superman, Batman, Iron Man, and the Avengers, for instance. These are the starring characters in some of the highest-grossing movies of the last couple of years. Looking farther back over the last 35 years, there have been several big-budget movies showing the adventures of characters owned by DC and Marvel Comics. Some of these movies have even earned critical respect, but it's their financial earnings that ensure that there will be more superhero movies in the future, including a new Thor movie that's due out on Friday. Mark Hughes is a screenwriter himself who writes about superheroes and movies in many places, including articles for Forbes. Mark Hughes, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
And I was intrigued. The fact that a business magazine is interested in superhero movies, I guess, should tell us how successful commercially they've become.
Yes. Just since 2008, for example, look at how many of the modern superhero films have broke the $1 billion barrier. You know, Batman has done it twice. You've got the Avengers. Superman just, of course, topped $650 million. Iron Man this year did $1.2 billion. So it's definitely a lucrative business.
Well, Mark, there was a time when the only movies about comic book heroes were low-budget serials aimed strictly at kids. So how did we get to the point where superhero movies have big budgets and storylines that may actually work on more than one level?
Well, I think you can see the change beginning in about the 60s or 70s. Prior to that, you had the Comics Code Authority in comic books that censored comics and kind of kept them at more of a kid-friendly level, and you had a lot more camp in them, which was reflected, of course, in the 60s Batman series. But in the 70s, you had a new generation of writers and artists who really took these stories and said, you know, we can change things. Marvel introduced a whole revolutionary group of characters like the Fantastic Four and Spider-Man, and these were complicated people. And that carried into the 80s, and then you got Watchmen and The Dark Knight Returns, and those were kind of watershed moments that brought mainstream focus on the fact that comics were a serious medium. And it was in 1978, I think. Yeah, 1978, Superman the movie came along, and it was like Gone with the Wind compared to the 60s Batman series. People were starting to see that, you know, there's a bigger audience for this if you take it seriously. And then Batman in 89 was really kind of the clincher. It showed you can make a dark adult superhero movie and audiences will show up. And they showed up to the tune of in excess of $400 million at the box office and more than that in merchandising.
And I should note, if you have a question for Mark Hughes, don't wait. Call now. We can talk about comic book movies at 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-WILL. You can email us at WILL-talk@illinois.edu. the progress, the evolution in special effects, just in terms of spectacle, must have also played a role in what comic book movies can look like.
Yeah, it played a huge role, actually, and I think that's the modern comic books, if you look at the 90s, things kind of stuttered a little bit. In the mid-90s, you had the Batman and Robin movie and a lot more unsuccessful and campy kind of approach to superheroes for a bit. But there were a few series, like The Crow and the Blade series in particular, that really carried that torch for more serious movies and more serious approach to comics. And what happened is around 2000, you had the late 90s, early 2000s, visual effects made a huge leap forward. And when that happened, you could finally portray the X-Men, for example, or Spider-Man in realistic ways on film. You know, you didn't have to have a lot of rope and wire and tilting the camera on its side so they looked like they were walking up a wall. And when you could present it believably, it added to that the illusion of realism for the audience and the buy-in to that kind of thing. You could suspend your disbelief, and I think that played a huge role in helping really galvanize the support in the mainstream public for these movies.
I'm thinking about these superhero movies from a business standpoint, and I was thinking you could make a movie about a totally original superhero that had never appeared before in other media. I can't really think of an example right now. Maybe you could talk about the emphasis on well-established characters from publishers with well-established marketing networks.
Sure. It's not essential to pre-sell the characters and to have them pre-existing in comics. It obviously doesn't hurt, though. But, you know, don't forget, we have actually had some very successful superhero films that had no prior comics. Hancock, for example, was a big success. It did close to or about, I think it did about $500 million, in excess of $400 million for sure at the box office with Will Smith. You have The Incredibles from Pixar, which was animated, but that's considered by a lot of people to be one of the best superhero films of all time. You had Unbreakable with Bruce Willis. That was a wonderful movie that's really loved by fans as a serious, realistic take on superheroes. And then just recently you had the found footage film Chronicle about teenagers who get superpowers, and that was a big success and was a great movie. So it's not, you don't have to have it, but I think, and if you look at Marvel's films, they kicked off their movies with Iron Man and Captain America, and these weren't, you know, on the level of Superman or Batman. A lot of people weren't really that familiar with them, and now they've got Ant-Man and Guardians of the Galaxy coming up. I think the mainstream public has figured out we love these movies, and there are certain brands like Marvel or DC, but especially Marvel has really branded themselves. So when you see that Marvel logo, you're going to show up, even if that character, you don't know who that is. So at this point, they could probably start introducing original characters in the films who don't exist in comics. And most of the public that goes to see these movies now wouldn't really know, you know, and probably wouldn't care as long as it's good.
I'm wondering, though, when they do make plans for these movies, say at Marvel and DC, is it part of the business plan for them to look not just at the revenue stream that will come from the movie, but the revenue stream that will come from all the ancillary products connected to the movie, as you know, as well as the kick that it might give to the original comic book series itself?
Oh, definitely. Yes, definitely. You know, for just one great example, again, the first Batman film in 1989, Tim Burton's Batman made in excess of $400 million at the worldwide box office. Most people don't know that it made more than that on merchandising.
Can a movie that maybe didn't do so well at the box office pick up, you know, still be considered a success because of what it did in merchandising?
It would have, if it flopped at the box office, it would be tough to call it a success necessarily. But in general, yeah, sure, it's possible that, look at Watchmen, for example. The Watchmen, which I think is a very underrated movie, I think it was terrific, and it's one of the best superhero films that was ever made, in my opinion. But it didn't do that well at the box office. But sales of the graphic novel for the Watchmen comic, they sold millions of copies, new copies of that, in the year leading up to the release of the film, just off of the buzz and the interest in that project. And then, of course, on DVD and Blu-ray, the profit levels are so much higher. You've got profit margins. It costs them like, 10 cents or something to make these DVDs, and they're selling them. And even though you hear that the DVD market is kind of depressed now, but at the end of the day, the profit margins are wide enough. I mean, Harry Potter, some of the Harry Potter films made between $250 and $500 million on Blu-ray and DVD. So if a film does well enough in merchandising, then as long as they can hope to break even or squeak out just a couple of bucks in their pocket at the box office, they can make that up on home entertainment and merchandising.
Both DC and Marvel now, of course, are now part of big media companies that do also own movie studios, DC part of Time Warner and Marvel part of Disney. How do you think the two companies are doing at producing and marketing movies made from their comic books?
I think they're doing great. Personally, I think Marvel is completely ahead of the game, and I wrote about this on Forbes Online just a few days ago, that I believe Marvel right now is dominating. Marvel, Disney are dominating the superhero genre right now.
What sort of things are they doing right?
Well, the biggest thing they've done, I think, is when you look at how Marvel approaches these movies, they seem fearless. They have so much confidence in their product, and they are so sure that you're going to love it. There's an excitement. It's like they can't wait to make another one of these movies just so you can see what happens next. And how often do you really get that feeling from a movie studio? They're making, these are live-action comic books. The Marvel films are like a comic book coming to life on this big screen. This is what comics would look like if they moved on the page, essentially. And they embrace that. They wear it on their sleeve. I totally respect and get the Warner Brothers approach that, the Batman films were saying, we're going to transcend the genre. This is not a typical superhero movie. But there's also something to be said for the fact that, Marvel says, we're not going to act like we need to transcend comic books. Comic books are great. It's a completely valid, wonderful storytelling medium, and there's no need to try to transcend it. They wear that on their sleeve. And because of that, they've branded their movies as Marvel the Avengers. The Marvel brand, I think, is like Disney. When you hear Disney, you think family films. People buy into it, not just the film itself, but the brand, the Disney brand. And Marvel has done that for superhero films. They've achieved that level. And their marketing, every one of their films ties to the next, and all of the marketing strategies tie together. And I think that they've been brilliant about keeping that really organized and knowing where they're going. They're not two steps ahead. They're 5 and 10 steps ahead at this point. And Warner Brothers is catching up, and Warner's, I think, to their credit, they looked at what's happening with Marvel, and they said, Marvel Studios make only superhero movies. Warner's makes lots of other kinds of movies. They don't have to try to match Marvel movie for movie. So they're taking a different approach. They're going to go a little slower. They're going to try for a realism approach in their movies instead. And for audiences, that's great. It wouldn't be as fun if everything looked the same. So, I appreciate that they're taking those different approaches, but at this point, Marvel's marketing is far and away dominating the genre.
Where have the Marvel movies been showing up in terms of how their box office does? I don't think I've seen things like the Thor and Captain America movies showing up, say, among the top grossers, for instance, but do they need to?
Well, that's a good point. That on the one hand, I think what Marvel did, they knew that the Avengers was coming, and they were confident that the Avengers would be a hit. And what they did is they said, we're not going to look at it on a film-by-film basis. We're going to invest in all of these movies together, and as long as all of these movies together combined return on that investment, that's what really matters to them. The Avengers made $1.5 billion because of all the groundwork they laid before. Even if none of those movies themselves made $1 billion, it didn't matter because the payoff was the Avengers. Look at that, $1.5 billion. They knew they were building a brand. They knew that if they built it and they were patient, this would pay off. And the films actually were pretty successful. You know, the first Iron Man broke $500 million. The second Iron Man broke $600 million. Thor did about $450 million. Captain America did, I think, $360 or $370 million, I believe, worldwide. The Hulk was really the one underperforming movie at the box office, but it was still a great movie, and Marvel didn't blink an eye. Compare that to Warner Brothers' reaction when Green Lantern kind of floundered. They put a halt to all their plans and had to completely rethink what they were doing with superhero movies when Green Lantern made about the same amount of money as the Hulk. Marvel didn't even blink. They kept right on going. They had their next movie and their next movie because it didn't matter if one of those movies stumbled, the rest could help it back up. And now, you know, what happened in the aftermath of the Avengers? Iron Man came back and made $1.2 billion. Iron Man 3 made $1.2 billion. Thor looks like it's going to open somewhere between $80 and $100 million domestic. It's already made over $130 million overseas. So it's on track for at least $600 million worldwide. If it catches fire a little bit better and it performs a little stronger domestically, it could hit $700 million domestically. So Thor is going to perform like Superman. What does that tell you? You know, Marvel's definitely doing something right now.
What's the role of the global market in how these movies perform?
The global market now accounts for, 60 to 70% of a movie's box office nowadays. If you're talking about films that are in, say, the top 50 performers, top 30 to 50 performers, your box office is about 60 to 70%. And in the top 10 or 20 movies, it's consistently two-thirds to 70 or even, in some cases, 75% of the box office.
Now, this is interesting. We're talking about a really American product. It's nothing that's to me that says America like superheroes, but they really depend on the money they make outside of America.
Yes, very much so. And you'd be surprised, actually. The superheroes, especially Marvel superheroes, like Iron Man and Spider-Man, have been hugely popular for decades in Asian countries, for example. And I think what's happening is, and the 3D really helps. It's worth mentioning that. The expansion, everyone thinks that 3D is dead. 3D is not dead at all. 3D reached a plateau domestically. It kind of surged at the front, and then it kind of, people were like, okay, we're over the novelty of it. And it's kind of settled at about, 30 to 40% now. But overseas, they're still building 3D theaters. They love 3D, and people turn out for these movies, and they're willing to pay the extra ticket price to see it in 3D. So that really helps boost that box office quite a bit. So we can't just, you know, we can't really ignore the fact that the ticket sales overseas are kind of inflated a little bit from that, and that helps a lot. But at the end of the day, they love the characters because it's mythology. You don't see a lot of filmmaking that represents mythology anymore, but that's what these are. You know, this is, when you read Roman and Greek mythology, it's superheroes, and that's what these are. And the world is kind of hungry for that kind of thing, I believe. And the fantasy elements and the sci-fi elements and the humor, and it's such a big world and it takes place. It's not just set in America. You know, that's a distinction between DC and Marvel movies, is very often the DC movies, they're all set in an American city, whereas with Marvel, it kind of travels all over a little bit. You know, even if all over means outer space, it's still all over.
Well, there's of course, there's a new superhero movie coming out tomorrow, Thor: The Dark World. Have you had a chance to see it in preview?
I did. I saw it at an advanced screening a couple of weeks ago, and it was really great. I think it takes all of the things that were great about the first movie, and it enhances them. It's not just set on Earth. It's set on the film takes place on a lot of different worlds. It's really, really fun. It's really exciting. The effects look great.
So you recommend this one?
Oh, I definitely recommend it.
Okay.
I don't know if you saw the news. Marvel announced with Netflix this morning they're developing 4 new superhero TV series exclusively for streaming on Netflix.
Now, that's
so there you go.
That's another thing. Daredevil, Jessica Jones, Iron Fist, Luke Cage, and The Defenders. Do you think this is going to make another difference as far as the media spread of superheroes?
Definitely. When you look at Netflix, they're worldwide. They have tens of millions. I think, what is their subscriber base now? 40 to 60 million people, I believe, worldwide. It's getting outrageous. And Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. this week was the number one program on Tuesday night among males 18 to 49 years old. That's, you know, that's a huge block of demographics right there. Now it's on television. You know, it's not just in movies anymore. And they're developing, Marvel's going to have superhero team-up. They're building towards a team-up TV series. That's what The Defenders is. It will be a mini-series that's like The Avengers, but with a different set of characters. They're spreading everywhere. And controlling it across these different mediums and platforms is really important. I think Marvel looked at the situation and saw the future of television is in a mixture between the streaming and online kind of content production and the traditional TV models, and they're already moving into that. They're really ahead of the game.
Just in a final minute, and we really just have a minute left, so I hope I'm not springing something too complicated. The comic books themselves, back to the old comic books on paper, what role do they start playing in a big business like Marvel and DC? Are they straitjacketed by some of the dictates of what's happening on movies and TV with the characters? Or is this the place where people can take risks?
No, they're still taking risks. I think what happens is the more successful the movies are, there's, of course, going to be a little more pressure in the comics to try to mirror that because fans see it in the movies and they're kind of... But for the most part, if you look at the comic books, you see a little spillover, just like the movies are taking influence from the comics. The comics take a little influence from what works best in the movies. But at the end of the day, they're still they're keeping it separate, especially, you know, right now DC's comic books are completely different than what they do with the films. So it's nice that as fans, you can get all different kinds of superheroes from different places, whatever your taste preference is.
Well, Mark Hughes, thank you for joining us on Focus today to talk about superheroes and movies and TV.
Oh, thank you very much, Jim. I appreciate it.
And thanks to Bill Roseman of Marvel Comics for talking to us earlier in the program. Changing Military is next. This is Focus on WYLL.
Students from University Laboratory High School in Urbana interviewed former U.S. servicemen and women to learn about their attitudes towards the military. All this week, we will hear their stories. Today, in part four of The Changing Military, we listen to the struggles of women seeking combat roles. Series producer Liev Haig narrates the story written by Uni High student Nafisa Sayed.
Women's involvement with the U.S. military dates back to the Revolutionary War, when they worked primarily as cooks, laundresses, and nurses. However, since World War II, their roles in the military have undergone a major transformation. During that war, women volunteers provided crucial support services to soldiers on the front lines. Jill Knappenberger, who volunteered with the Red Cross during World War II, remembers the strong ties she formed with the soldiers she served.
They respected us like they would their sisters, sweethearts, brothers, aunts, or, you know, if there was a house that had a roof, when they're moving along, they'd see that we got us. Good as anybody did. Our relationship was very friendly. They loved to see us, and we loved to see them because we were doing what we liked and what they wanted. It was mutual admiration, I guess you'd say.
During and after World War II, opportunities for women to serve in the military steadily grew. Although women were not officially allowed to serve in combat, modern warfare blurred the distinction between combat and non-combat roles. The growing presence of women challenged the male-dominated environment of the military. Shaheen Shorish served in the Navy during the 1990s.
I made some good friends in the military, male friends, and they were good people. And they were straight-up good men. They had honor. Even if they had their own private opinions of women in the military or what have you, they never let me know it. They were actual leaders. They got the job done, and they did so in a way that didn't cause anything. There was no divisiveness. But overall, there was still a military mindset that was just getting used to women walking around. The old guard was still there, so to speak, of the attitude of women. Can they pull their own weight? Can they do these things? There is a constant uphill struggle to prove oneself. Constant, because if you made one mistake, you made a mistake for all of womankind. And no one was ever going to forget it. So there was a lot of double standards out there for the behavior of men and women. And it was keenly felt.
Jerry Young, who served during the Iraq War, observed the difficulties faced by women in the transition from civilian to military life.
The difference between a male civilian role and a male military role is theoretically not that different. You know, males from their infancy are encouraged to be my little fighter, or my little slugger, or something like that. They're socialized to have those more aggressive, more confrontational type roles. That is lauded in the military. You want that type of aggression because of what you do. Females, you know, they're dressed in pink and they're the little princesses, and then you go into the military and you need to be the little slugger.
Despite opposition, women have continued to make progress in the military. In February 2013, the long-standing ban on women in ground-level combat was lifted, giving servicewomen more opportunities. Shoresh experienced firsthand hostility towards the idea of women in combat.
This one guy was telling me, oh, women in combat, no way, that's just bad. And I'm like, women are in combat almost every day. When you think about all the rapes they have to fend off and all the garbage they have to deal with, you think women are in some sort of ivory tower where they don't see violence? You know, they don't see the ugly side of society? Women are fighting in wars since we've had wars. I know that many armies have women in them, and they have guns, and they use them.
I'm Leif Haig.
Tomorrow, in part 5 of our series, The Changing Military, we look at the struggle to integrate gays in the military and hear more in our documentary, From the Front Lines to the Home Front, Inside Views of the Military, 1940 to 2012. The hour-long program produced by University Laboratory High School students airs Saturday, November 9th at 6 p.m. on AM 580 with a rebroadcast on November 11th at 10 a.m.